I actually have a necklace of it's a piece of deer antler.
Oh, really?
I always think, you know, if you were to be buried with that, and then someone to dig it up, then we would try and infer all sorts of ritual activity, you know.
Ah, you're a multi millennial troll.
yeah. They look, they deposited him with deer antler, so he must have been master of the deer.
That's hysterical. I want to do that now. I'm going to go around and troll people thousands of years from now by burying random things together.
The ultimate commitment to a joke.
That's right.
More of that conversation to come up soon, but first, a word from our sponsors. Welcome to the Wait What If podcast. This episode is brought to you by Onnit. waitwhatif.com/Onnit. Onnit is a total human optimization website. You can go there and learn about athletics. You can go there and learn about nootropics, which, if you don't know what that is, Google it. It's basically supplements for your cognitive thinking, cognitive abilities. So you take supplements for your muscles, you take them for your bones, you take them for basically your entire body, but we don't take it for our cognitive abilities. So Onnit has Alpha Brain, which is proven by science. The Boston Memory Center did some double-blind placebo studies and found that there's actually a benefit for taking it. So if you don't believe me, go to the site and you can read all the data that they have. If you like kind of alternative workout methods, meaning you don't want to just push a barbell up, if you want to get more functional strength, more grip strength, arm strength, flexibility, which is my big issue right now, is just I'm getting so unflexible. I'm like tightening up like a ball, and I'm working on different methods to try to open up my joints, my shoulders, my hips. One of the things I'm using is the steel mace, which is basically a cannonball at the end of a bar, and it's kind of awkward to hold. It pulls your joints in different directions, which is better for me because, you know, just doing bench pressing and stuff like that has really kind of tightened me up, and it's led to injuries. So I'm a big fan of Onnit. You should be too. So check it out. It's waitwhatif.com/Onnit. Today's episode, I invited Tom Bell, a archaeology student out of Great Britain. I discovered him on Reddit, actually, on an Ask Me Everything. Apparently, he was a student. He volunteered for a dig at an area called Starcar, Starcarr, I think. It's kind of a cool site, couple 10, 12,000 years old, and he was just rummaging through the dirt, and he found the oldest piece of Mesolithic art in Great Britain's history, which is kind of cool. I don't quite know what Mesolithic means, but he explains it all. So stay tuned, and we'll chat with Tom.
You're listening to the Wait What If podcast. As always, your host, Kevin Sullivan.
And so with us today is Tom Bell. Tom is a student. I'm going to say student archaeologist. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So what part of London are you in? Or England, sorry.
I'm currently in Sheffield.
I haven't been to... I've been to Prestwick, Scotland, and kind of that whole area up there, Ayr.
But it's so nice in Scotland.
Oh, yeah, it's gorgeous. But I never made it down. I used to be in the military. I did some flying with the RAF.
Oh, yeah.
And I can tell you those guys are a little crazy, actually.
Where did you fly?
I flew C-130s, but our planes were so old that they'd break down, and I would often spend... I mean, I've probably spent 2 months total in Scotland. And because we always had to... be ready to go on a moment's notice if our plane got fixed, I could never really travel far. So yeah, I only got to hang out in Scotland and little random towns like Ayr, and I don't remember. It's been over 10 years, so it's kind of
too much to remember then.
Yeah, it really just you get kind of stuck in your, you know, your present situation, and you kind of forget stuff. Yeah. So happy birthday, by the way. How old you turn?
Oh, thank you. 22. Yeah.
Ah, you're just a young bloke. Let's get going, I guess. Let's start with your background. So you're 22.
Yeah.
I take it you're in the States, 22 would put you just out of college and maybe starting graduate school, or kind of explain that to me.
Yeah, so I did 3 years of my undergraduate, and then I'm now doing a master's course.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we do our master's mostly in a year.
Okay. Oh, wow. So after after 4 years, you're pretty much done with college up to that level.
Well, you can stop straight. So you do your undergraduate, and that's only 3 years, and then there's not many people go on to do a master's straight away.
Okay. Yeah, it takes a lot of work, takes a lot of dedication, especially when you're 18 to 22. Not a lot of people really know what they want to do. And then, you know, they kind of get thrown into, it just becomes expected that you go to college.
Well, I always found that when we were in college, you always pushed to, I mean, at this point, you're only 16, 17, and people are saying, right, you've got to choose a university degree, you've got to know what you want to do. And at that point, it's so difficult to actually know and get it right.
Sure, it's impossible. Your brain isn't fully developed, believe it or not, till you're probably just after 22, 23. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you take a 16-year-old, in our case, an 18-year-old, and you say, hey, you're about to, in the States, you're about to drop maybe 40,000, maybe more, maybe a little less on a really important stage in your life. What do you want to do? And, you know, most people just say, I want a $40,000 four-year party. And that tends to be the unfortunate outcome here.
Yeah, my younger brother's he's 17 at the moment, and he's just having to go through the whole, he's picking up what he's going to do at uni, and he's just got no idea.
Yeah, and maybe it's a rite of passage. Maybe it's something in our culture that says, you know, you're done being a child, start to focus and get a direction. And perhaps it's, if we give excuses about, like, you know, you're too young to think of that stuff, maybe that's the wrong thing. Maybe it is that you have to go in and start focusing.
Even if at some point you focus on and you pick something and it's the wrong thing, I suppose eventually it will lead you to decide that.
Let's get going, I guess. One of the ways I find guests, believe it or not, is I go onto Reddit, Ask Me Anythings, and I just flip through there and I look for people that are interesting. I mean, you can go on the Ask Me Anythings. There's the AMAs and the IAMAs, and you know, you can find some, you know, famous people, directors, but then you find just regular folks who have really interesting stories. So I look for folks like that, and then I just drop them a line and say, hey, you got an interesting story? Do you want to come on my show? What I first read was, I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember what it was like, I found the oldest Mesolithic art in Great Britain. And when I heard that, I thought, wow, that's very specific. And I translated it, and I might have been wrong, I translated it as, I basically found the oldest art in Great Britain. Is that accurate?
There's some older cave art in Britain.
Oh, there is.
Okay. Yeah. So there's some from the Paleolithic period, but Mesolithic is a lot less. There's not much evidence.
Okay.
And so to find the art from it was unbelievable.
So tell me about the Mesolithic. Where does that fall in relation to, I guess, modern times?
So the pendant was, it's hard to remember. I think the pendant was dated to maybe 11,000 BC. So it's just a period in prehistory between the Neolithic and the Paleolithic. And the Neolithic is more when you start getting the domestication of animals, and it leads to a more sedentary lifestyle. The Mesolithic is very hunter-gatherers and stuff.
And nomadic, right.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's pretty cool. So you found the pendant in Star Car. Am I pronouncing it right? I mean, it looks like Star Car to me, but...
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Okay, S-T-A-R, and then space, and then C-A-R-R. And it's and I was doing a little research on it. It's a pretty famous archaeological site. It looked like it was in the mid-1940s that they first started digging there, or was it a little bit earlier?
No, in the mid-1940s, yeah, it was when it was first dug. It's been dug for so many years, and it's turned up so many amazing finds. And last year was actually the last year we were digging it. So it's it's not been opened again, I don't think.
Your experience goes to show you that it's never a finished project. I mean, how could it be? Because you're basically going into a spot where you only have an idea that people were there. I mean, you found, or not you, but, you know, archaeologists in general found some headpieces. I believe there were some wooden structures, right, that were preserved from the peat?
Yeah, there are huge, huge timber platforms.
Gosh, see, that's amazing. Wooden platforms that are 11,500 years old.
It's so crazy. You know, when, especially at the site and watching the scale of the platforms, they're just so huge.
Now, are they still relatively intact?
It's intact. It's intact to look at.
Okay.
But the preservation recently of the site is still unbelievable. But from maybe three, four years ago, has changed so much that things are just turning into like you say, mush and jelly, which is why the excavation had to happen. It was a rescue excavation just to see if we could get the last things out.
And what do they think the location was? Was this a town, a village, or was it a like ritualistic site? What exactly was it?
So it's actually a site which is on a paleo lake edge. So the lake's not there anymore, but it would have been situated on a lake edge. They think it's a ritual site. Yeah.
It opens up such a can of worms because, all right, it's a ritual site. It's 11,000 years old. To put it in perspective, right?
Yeah.
And we can kind of put our finger on the time of Jesus. And we know that is so long ago that, I mean, we tend to think there's a ton of information on the Christian era. We tend to think that. But really, there's not a lot that's left. I mean, we find some writing on stone. We find some scrolls. And then people over the last 2,000 years have kind of pieced together a story. That's not even, you know, 20% of what you're talking about, these relics are from. You're talking 11, almost 12,000 years ago, where...
Yeah.
Where does your, I mean, it really conjures up the imagination, which is kind of was going to be my next question leading into this, is what got you into archaeology? Do you find that you have like a science mind? Do you find that you have a creative mind? Is it a combination of the two?
I think I have no memory, but apparently my mum tells me it was something that I always said I wanted to do. We actually found a Christmas list from when I was 7, not too long ago, and the top thing on it was an archaeology kit.
Oh, that's cool.
So I was in college, and I was trying to pick what degree to do. I had no idea. And something that looks good on any sort of application was volunteering. I just decided, I was interested in history. I was like, okay, I'm going to volunteer on this excavation. And I did, and that was it.
Wow.
I was hooked.
So this, when you found the pendant, you weren't a committed archaeology student at the time?
No, sorry. That was a different excavation. I did that, and then I decided, yes, I want to do archaeology.
Okay.
And I did that at university, and then that led to working on Starkar with some of my lecturers from university.
Okay, all right, that makes a little more sense.
Yeah.
When I was a child, believe it or not, I wanted to go into archaeology when I was, you know, probably around the same age, 7 to 10. I ended up becoming a history major, and I studied actually modern European history, focusing on Great Britain, pretty much Victorian era to present. That again, I graduated in 99, and a lot of that information's lost in my brain. Because I got out and I was like, what am I going to do with this? I wasn't going to teach. I ended up going into the military, and then from there, just life has a way of kind of pushing you in different directions. And so that kind of goes back to how we opened up this conversation, college and what it means to us. But when I was a kid, what it was, and I'm sure, I mean, you're a lot younger than me, but I'm sure, or maybe this had something to do with it too. I was addicted to Indiana Jones. And Johnny Quest, and pretty much anything that had to do with that. So that's what I expected as a kid, what an archaeologist was.
Being chased by boulders and
Yeah, I assume, and I guess I'm pretty right just from the research I've done on Star Car and whatever. It's obviously a lot different.
See, it's not quite like that.
Yeah, no. Yeah. So it's explain to me what going on a dig is like, especially as a volunteer, because I assume you're at the bottom of the bottom rung of the ladder, right? They're just kind of telling you what to do, and you just spend the hours doing it, right?
I think when we sometimes we have members of the public volunteer, and that's what I was on the first dig, and that was so great because. Yes, you were told, you know, you have this is what we need to do, but there was no sort of like strictness to it. It was all very I loved it. I thought it was so friendly, and I had so much fun. When we go to Stark Arts, you know, it was all very like, oh, this is what we do. We have to dig, and it's not like Indiana Jones. You know, it's all very meticulous, and you take everything down in layers and record everything and
sure
make sure that it's all preserved and lifted properly.
So there were no boulders that chased you out of any sort of caverns or anything?
No, it's so disappointing.
Damn it. So and that's, I mean, that kind of steps us towards the direction of this little, you know, this little pendant that you found, because had you not been methodical, had you just, you know, been digging away, this could have easily been overlooked, right?
Yeah, 100%. There's it is really small, and I think the trick is that you have to be patient and yeah, methodical, and just keep your eye out and concentrate. There's a lot of concentration.
Sure, yeah, that's got to be. It's got to be a very zen activity, I would think.
Yeah.
Do you find that you're a mellow person as a result of it?
Yeah, I think so. I'm quite laid back, and I've always loved being outdoors, and so. I think digging into something that is so interesting is just so perfect for me.
Tell me about how you actually found the pendant itself.
Oh, we were just—it was coming to that. It was the, like last few days of the excavation, really looking to wind up, and we're just removing the last layers of the lake, so we're getting to the natural ground. I just saw this; just looked like a stone. It was so smooth and. You know, you've seen the picture, it's like guitar plectrum shaped, and I just picked it up, and I only picked it up because it was a smooth stone. It was so muddy and like you couldn't make anything out on it, and then as I picked it up and I just cleaned it off a little bit, just have a look, and I realized that it was a perforation on it, and I knew there has been beads found at the site before, but none of them decorated. And so then, you know, I realized it was one of the beads. I cleaned it off some more, and you know, and then you see the decoration. So I called the supervisor over and I said, "Oh, look, you know." And then I think initially when I found it, it's exciting, but you only begin to realize like how exciting it actually is when like everyone on the site is you know coming over to have a look and see.
Sure. So it ginned up a lot of excitement initially, huh?
Yeah, because we knew that we'd had no art on this site and not in Britain from the Mesolithic, not really.
Wow.
And so even for it to be Mesolithic art was great. As soon as the word got out, you know, on site, and we all came and had a look and checked it over. The more research that has been done on the pendant, the more exciting it actually becomes.
Sure, and there's a lot of info out there. I don't know if you saw my Twitter, but I posted there was a 3D scan of it, and it, for the listeners, you can go to my Twitter. I don't remember how long ago, it was maybe a week or so ago, but you get a really good idea of what this looks like, and the scratches, really. That's all the art kind of looks like, as someone took a piece of stone and scratched some patterns into it.
Yeah, the scratches are so small, and then... You see them in, and there's some like tiny notches on there, and they're so precise. And what amazes me, I think, is the accuracy of what is done. The notches that they're so small, but they're obviously on purpose. And then the hole itself is literally perfect.
Oh yeah, I remember seeing that. Yeah, it looks like it was drilled out.
Yeah, it's so crazy. It's so perfect, and and round. I think that was what is so amazing.
And I like to think of things both on the scientific level and on the human level. But so, like, again, you know, 11,000-12,000 years ago is so far removed from anything we understand today that it's almost fiction, right? It's we kind of shared a planet. It didn't even look the same. You know, the continents are different. It was so different. I mean, they might as well have been an alien race.
Yeah.
And to hold something in your hand that someone so far removed from us held on their hand, and to look at the scratches that someone, it obviously meant something to them. You know, you're not going to, like you said, spend this meticulous time putting these notches or putting these scratches on the surface unless it means something personal to them. And to hold it in your hand, knowing that it was held in this person's hand, it puts a connection beyond millennia, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, I think it's so great. And that's partly something I love about archaeology is, you know, you can discover something like this and you can pick it up and, you know, it's not been disturbed or touched until it was, you know, deposited there. You can never truly know what those scratches meant.
Yeah. But one of the things I always liked about history is, you know, just walking through an old house or, you know, looking, I still like history, you know, we go to museums and stuff, but I think I was telling you in an email that I once dragged my wife to, it wasn't the Natural History Museum. I think it was the North Carolina History Museum. And inside the oldest stuff we have, I mean, we have stuff from the Native American period, and that's probably as old as you're going to get. And then a lot of this stuff was from the Civil War, and, you know, that's only 150 years ago. To kind of go off on a tangent here, that's one of the weird things about being in the U.S. and then traveling the world. The oldest stuff you're going to find in the U.S. might be old Native American sites, right? And those are even hard to find because they were nomadic people, so they didn't have societies. They weren't really, you know, they were, you know, would pick up and move, so there's really not a lot that they find. You can find arrowheads and stuff. That's very common, but there's nothing really established. Whereas when I would travel through Europe or when I was in the Middle East, there was a thing in southern Iraq called the ziggurat. It's outside of, I can't remember the name of the town. I want to say it's Nasiriya, but I stood on the steps and growing up in a culture where the oldest thing is maybe 250 years old. And then to stand on the steps of something that's pre-biblical, it really messes with your psyche. I mean, as my culture, which we share a culture, but still as an American, it's really surreal. It's kind of hard to believe. Cause then again, you know, when I was in Prestwick, Scotland or Ayr, the town of Ayr, I walked by, I think it was, a church that Robert the Bruce gave a speech at or something. And that's only what, maybe 1,000 years ago? Am I right with that? It was about 1,200 maybe?
Yeah.
And that's still, I mean, that's enough to make your head spin.
I think when you're working at the site and seeing like the platforms and the headdresses and the pendant come up, it is so surreal. I think it's so hard to sit and think it's so old, you know. And you look at the stuff that's there, and I find it hard to get my head around. Really,
what's the process to start a dig into an old area? Do you guys study the land, study what you know? Let's say geologically, saying like, okay, we knew there used to be a lake here, so probably people would be on the side of it. So is that where you start to dig, or is it incidental? Do people just sort of dig something up and call the university and say, hey, come over and look at this?
There can be so many ways of discovering a site. So obviously Starkar was dug from the 1940s. But yeah, there's people can come across things by accident and call an archaeologist, or we can survey the land, you know, and that could give us an idea. Yeah. An idea of where to dig and what to, I think a lot of the excavations here are done before development, you know, like building development. So if you're going to build a building, a lot of areas have to be excavated beforehand if there's thought to be archaeology there. And I think that's where a lot of the digging is done here.
Isn't that how they found, it was just recently they found one of your king's,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, they found him under a car park.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Kind of an unromantic end to, you know, we like to think that we're meaningful on this earth, right? yeah. Even kings of entire kingdoms leave a legacy, and then there they are under a 1979 Peugeot that was dripping oil on it for, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you'd like to think that he had some sort of ceremonial burial, but...
Yeah.
Ended up under
you just, and then it makes it even more depressing for us non-kings and non-politicians. I'm going to get stuck in a plot somewhere, and in less than 100 years, there's going to be, I don't know, a strip mall. There's going to be McDonald's. it's a bit of a relief, because are you familiar with Carl Sagan has this, if you ever have a chance, look up on YouTube. It's called the Pale Blue Dot. And what it was, I want to say it was when the Voyager space capsule turned around at some point, maybe in the 70s or 80s, and it took a photograph of the Earth. But at that distance, it literally was one pixel in just an expanse of blackness. And Carl Sagan kind of waxes philosophically on it, and he says, he basically equates existence to being on this pale blue dot in the middle of nowhere, and how... how much blood was shed to rule over one small pixel for one small fragment of time on this pale blue dot. And it really, some would say it's depressing, maybe a dust in the wind type of thing, but I think it's liberating, because you worry and you get concerned and you spend a lot of time in life figuring out what you're going to do next and what impact you're going to make. But in the end, ask King, was it King Richard that they found buried? Yeah. In the end, what does it matter? It's all about right now, because thousands of years move in the blink of an eye, and you're really not going to be part of it that long. So
I like that. I like it.
So what kind of reaction from the professors and stuff, and the archaeologists that have been working for years? I mean, your find was quite significant, which kind of lends itself to luck in the field itself. Were you embraced by the faculty, or did they kind of resent you a little bit for finding this? How did that all happen?
So firstly, I was actually, my girlfriend is also an archaeologist.
Okay.
We're working together on StarCar, and we're directly next to each other. When she was next to me when I found the pendant, but we decided that's where we were going to dig. We moved in, and she knelt down on the right hand side, and then just something in me, I was just like, oh, I kind of want to be on that side. So she was like, okay, yeah, it's fine. So we switched, and then maybe 2 minutes later, I had found the pendant. So she resents me.
Such is life, though. I mean, that's kind of the way things work.
Yeah, but no. Like I say, it was the last few days, so it became quite stressful. We realized we had 2 days left, 1 day left, and we were still turning up unbelievable finds and stuff. So the supervisor on site at the time was like, stop finding things.
Oh, really? So there was more than this pendant that you guys pulled up?
Oh, yeah. The last few days on site was such hard work, because we discovered... A trench in between a more recent excavation and an old excavation. It was maybe only a meter and a half wide, that it was just full of animal bones and wooden artifacts and headdresses. I think there were two or three in there. And we discovered this in the last week, and we realized that we had to get all of that out and recorded before we finished up. So got quite hard work, but the professors are... They were great. They're so happy to just, you know, have the artifact, really.
Did they think that site disappeared quickly? Or, because when you talk about things like that, it sounds like, so animal bones would be refuse for us. It would be just garbage, right? Because, you know, kill the animal, eat it. You take what you need from the animal, and then the bones just get thrown in a pile. Basically, how does it go from being an active place to just nothing, or is that part of the mystery?
Well, Stark Alec was on the lake edge, and so we think a lot of the artifacts are actually d- deposited in there.
Okay.
And that's why it's thought to be a ritual site, because these things would have been placed in the edge of the water.
Okay, that makes sense. And then the water would have taken it or whatever?
Or just, you know, and then slowly get taken into the ground and, you know, more layers on top of it.
Are you a, do you espouse the belief of gradualism versus catastrophism as far as, I guess, the connection to our ancient world? By which I mean, I've read some books. I read one, and I guess in the scientific world, a lot of people cringe when you say Graham Hancock. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he followed, I want to say the guy's name was Frisk or Fisk. He was a North American geologist slash, I guess you could say, archaeologist that studied what they call the Badlands up in, or I'm sorry, the Craglands or something like that up in Washington State in the U.S. And he looked at areas, or they look at more of stone deposits and how stone deposits get there and what made them get there. So yeah, I guess that's basically more geology. But there is two schools of thought. There's one that gradually things happened. You know, there were floods, there were droughts, and things got moved around and societies dispersed as a result. And then there's another thought that received a lot of ridicule in the early 20th century, and then slowly gained a little more acceptance towards the latter half of the century. And that was catastrophism, where about 12,000 years ago, right when the, I want to say it was called the Younger Dryas started, which is like the second mini ice age.
Yeah.
A lot of these societies just sort of stopped and disappeared. And their idea is it didn't take a matter of, you know, it didn't take 1,000 years for this to happen. This took probably a couple weeks because of a meteor, or I don't know, what's the one that hits the earth? A meteorite? when a meteorite struck northern North America and basically blew out a glacier. So it was a glacial lake. And it makes sense when you look at it. And they say that the catastrophic event would have been global, and that around that time, 12,000 years ago, you would see a lot of these societies either disappear very quickly that's what it would be. I mean, disappear very quickly. There's like a layer of ash that they find worldwide that kind of correlates along to the same line. Are you familiar with this at all?
But I'm not actually. It sounds so interesting though.
Yeah, it is. Check it out. It's Graham Hancock, Magicians of the Gods. And you know, you got to take it with a grain of salt because he's a journalist.
Yeah.
And the folks he talks to, a lot of them are amateur. I mean, he does cite a lot of actual reference material from geologists and archaeologists. But some of them, one guy, and I can't think of his name right now. I can see him. He was on Joe Rogan, actually. He was on his podcast a couple months ago. but their evidence is very compelling. And the first, or one of the things that they continually go back to is Göbekli Tepe.
I've read a little bit of it, but my interest, I think, mostly is in British archaeology, and so I think I've tended to not ignore, but not focus on, you know, on other cultures so much, because I'm so interested in British, really.
And I guess that makes sense too, because you're still in school and you don't have time to go read off on something completely unrelated to what you're trying to study, right?
No, not. Right.
So the job of the archaeologist, I asked you this in an email, or I sent this to you. Is it to tell the story of the society? Is it to be the scientific individual who tries to uncover the story of the society? Tell me a little bit more about that.
I think we aim to understand the past, understand past communities. And it's got to be, you've got to take a scientific approach. You can't just make things up.
Sure. Yeah, I guess that makes sense. So you combine all the artifacts together and kind of figure out what a society looked like that long ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and then each little artifact will give you part of the idea, or the, you know, of what kind of makeup the society had. Yeah, it's no good just looking at one artifact in isolation, because you can interpret that in so many different ways, and then it's important to keep your mind open and take in every aspect of the excavation, and then you can come up with a much more complete picture, a much better idea.
What was at least at this point in your knowledge, what was society like 12,000 years ago in Great Britain? Or is that just way too open ended?
It was basic. It would be nomadic, definitely. There was no that we didn't have agriculture, so it was a very, like I say, it was a hunter gatherer.
Was it similar then? I mean, it's separated by thousands of miles, but would it be very similar to early American societies?
I imagine so. I imagine it was all, I wouldn't say basic, because you see, when you look at things like the pendants, you realize that there were technology, and you can look at like the stone tools that they had, and that all seems it worked. It worked for them. It was to us, it would seem very basic. And
what's amazing is the lack of communication, complete lack of communication. I mean, people in North America had no idea about the people in at least that we know of, the people in. and what would be modern Great Britain. But the similarities, I thought about this. So in the US, so a lot of people identify themselves as American first, but America is very different in that, like I said, our society is only a couple hundred years old, and we're made up of immigrants. Very small percentage of folks are indigenous to this country. So we always have like a secondary identification. And that's because, I mean, that's just how you're raised. People come in with Italian backgrounds and Irish backgrounds and whatever. So, my family, I'm Kevin Sullivan. So, two generations after the last one of us came over from Ireland, it's still very strong identification with having that Irish background. You go into my house, or my folks' house, there's a shillelagh hanging on the wall. There's Irish music playing. It's still very, the culture's there.
Yeah.
And I remember, I was at a, I don't know if it was a festival or at a pub where I went to college, but they were playing drums and they were singing an old Celtic song.
Yeah.
And what struck me as interesting was, aside from, the general sound, it was very similar, the story and the instruments and the dancing, to what you would see at a Native American festival. They had the early Celts had arrows, and they wore tanned leathers that they from the deer that they killed, same exact thing that you would see the early Americans do, and it was kind of an interesting thing.
Recently we were looking at the domestication of animals. What I thought was so interesting is that some animals were domesticated in one area and then that would spread out, but then other animals would be like domesticated in separate areas around about the same time. And I thought that was so interesting to think that the cultures were looking at,
sure,
with this animal and having the same thought, and doing the same thing at the pretty much a similar time.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Is it set in stone, so to speak, that generally around the world we went from hunter-gatherer nomadic to small domestication, started figuring out farming to societies, is it set in stone that sort of happened between 15,000 and 10,000 years ago? Or and the reason why I ask this is I'm thinking specifically of Göbekli Tepe. Göbekli Tepe is they dug up these monoliths that were, I don't even know how high, I want to say they were like maybe 15 meters high, multiple, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 ton rocks basically, but they were carved so beautifully and so perfectly. And they all had, they had this art on them, and they seemed to be buried for no reason. They don't know why they did it. It was right at the beginning of the Younger Dryas. And the idea there is, I know it's hard to date things. We can look at what's left around, right? The organic material that's left around and kind of get an idea there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if this site, I want to say, is 12,000 years old, doesn't that tell us that that was, I mean, if they were putting up megaliths, it was much more than a hunter-gatherer society at this time?
I don't necessarily. I think a hunter-gatherer can be not sedentary, but partly sedentary. You can have one camp here and one camp there, and you can move from camp to camp.
But to have the organization to actually put in, and I don't want to put you on the spot because I know you're still a student. If you say yes, there were organized societies back 15,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago, that could be wrong from the general thought of things. But basically, what I'm asking is, it set in stone that generally people were nomadic and there wasn't a established. There weren't cities. There weren't, well-established large societies back then.
That's the general thought. I suppose I can never say it can be set in stone because there could be some incredible, amazing discovery that could be made.
Yeah,
which would just completely throw everyone off. But from our knowledge,
okay,
it is thought that that it was a hunter-gatherer lifestyle in the Mesolithic, and then moving into the Neolithic, so about 4,000 years ago, then it becomes more sedentary, and as people start to farm and the domestication of animals comes in.
What Chauveau, something like that. The Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
Yeah,
that was the film by what's that guy's name? He's got a funny voice. He did the Grizzly Man movie.
I actually have never watched The Cave of Forgotten Dreams.
Oh, really?
You mentioned it, and I looked up the trailer. Decided it's definitely something I've got to watch. One of the depictions in the Chauveau cave, it's a hyena. Firstly, the question is, what is it? Obviously, it's a hyena, and then the question is, what would this have meant? And that I've been reading on that all of today, and I think that's definitely the hardest question to answer. I actually wanted to do a project on because I did abstract rock art for my undergraduate dissertation. I did a project on that, and then I just found it so interesting. I wanted to look at like pictures of animals and what that would have meant, and I wanted to look at whether the archaeological record showed what was depicted in rock art, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think for the listeners, and again I'm butchering the name, but Chauveau, it's French, Chauveau Cave, it's a 30 to 32,000 year old site where I don't remember how they found it, but I think they had some spelunkers had gone down, a few thousand meters. They were pretty deep into this cave, and they looked up and they saw these cave paintings, and they're like, holy shit, what are these doing this deep in here? And they're very intricate, very well preserved. So the French government obviously went in there and said, we got to preserve this. So they sealed it off. The cave right now is sealed off pretty tightly because they don't want people going in there and obviously, looting or too many pictures are going to fade the art. And only now and then they let I think they have it temperature controlled or something. I know they put in a pretty big system to preserve it. But one of the amazing things about it is obviously 32,000 years old. I mean, we were talking... your piece there that you found being 11,000 years old, this is three times that.
And to see, I think the art on the pendant and the abstract art that I looked at for my dissertation is so not like this. It just looks so accurate, and the pictures are so amazing, aren't they?
Yeah, and you're talking about just anatomically looking at some of these animals.
Yeah. They look so perfect, don't they?
Yeah. And
did you see that they came out this weekend, had decided that some of the artworks were actually 10,000 years older than they first thought?
No way. So you're talking 40,000 years old?
I think it was 37,000, something like 40,000, 37,000 that they decided to was what it was. I think they analyzed some of the animal bones in there, and I think they were bears, and they dated those and decided that they could actually be 10,000 years older than previously. I know.
What's and it's like a drop in the bucket. It's either, you know, 32,000, 42,000. I mean, you're the numbers are just, again, you just look it into how we judge things now by BC, and you know, we go by the biblical things. That's 2,000 years. That's not even a fraction of where they think they were off. You know what I mean?
I know. It's to. I think it just seems so like we because it's so removed from us. We just talk about it, you know, 10,000 years, 20,000 years. It doesn't really seem like that much, but when you really sit and think about the actual time frame.
Yeah, and you think about like, I know this kind of this may sound silly, but when I would deploy, I'd deploy for months at a time, and I would close up my apartment. You know, I'd cover things with blankets because I wouldn't want dust or bugs to get in. And then I would pack my car, and then I would walk out, and it's just a weird feeling to turn off the lights for the last time and realize I'm going to be gone for 6 months, right? And that's this is just going to sit here quietly for that amount of time.
And then it seems such a long time.
Yeah, and then you picture them. You know, whatever, when they were painting these pictures, which reminds me, I have a couple questions with that, but when they're painting these pictures, and then whenever they had left, 32,000 years of silence, you know, until somebody poked their head in and saw
I think, like I say, when we were working on StarCard to pick up the pendant and know that you were the first person to, you were the next person to pick it up.
Sure.
Does that make sense from the person that put it there to you being the next person, you know, 11,000 years later.
Yeah, and you think of the history that has happened. Like, it was sitting there during the Battle of Britain. It was sitting there during the War of the Roses. It was sitting there, you know, just in its same spot, maybe shifted a little bit because of the soil, but during all those things,
Even just to say it sat there for the whole of your life and not being...
Yeah,
seems such a long time, but in relative terms, it's nothing.
Yeah, it's really just a drop in the bucket. They think too when they looked at this. So the first thing they think of is how did these people go into this cave and paint them in the darkness? And then they realize, well, the cave. This was probably the opening of the cave. You know, that many millennia ago. And then
we actually went to Creswell Crags, which is a cave site in Britain. It's got Paleolithic art. Nothing like the Chero Cave. But when we went and we had a look at some of the art, and to see the difference in the then floor level to the now floor level was so difficult for me to picture them, because the floor level that they would have been on meant that they would have crawled into the cave, you know, on hands and knees.
Oh wow.
Whereas when we walk in, there's, you know, it's a huge space, and to look at, to try and understand how they got in and to, you know, put these decoration on the walls, and I found it so difficult to go and try and understand.
Yeah, and it also meant something to them, because if you're going to do that, it's not for everyone to see, or maybe it is. Maybe it is. We don't know what why they were doing it.
Yeah, that was. Like I say, that was what what I wanted to do was, you know, look at this and because it doesn't necessarily mean that they draw this because that's what they see.
Right.
At some point it could be, or we've had to draw these animals because this is what we don't have. This is what we haven't seen for a long time.
Right. So that was going to be my next question, because the last thing I think of in France, and again, we're talking so long ago that geography has changed, but there's rhinos, there's hyenas. What's the deal with that? How do these ancient people know of them? Were they there in Europe at that time?
Oh yeah, absolutely. There was woolly rhinos, giant deer, lions, bears. Yeah, there's totally different animals to here as to what there was. Yeah.
So do they, I mean, even hyenas that far north?
Yeah. The cave site that we went to actually has had a lot of hyena remains found.
Oh, wow.
And there's a PhD student in Sheffield who is doing a project specifically on the hyenas at that site.
That's amazing.
We went, and there's a exhibition at the moment on the hyenas, and there was a fully articulated baby hyena skeleton that we could see.
So
yeah.
So really, my original thought there was, these sites are so old and these people are so removed from us that they might as well be an alien society, and they technically were, right? Because the connection we have to them is just absolutely removed, just through, you know, the massive die-offs and even climate change over the years, geography change. That it wasn't the same planet, you know, it really wasn't. And what you know, our daily society, we don't have any carryovers of. I guess you could. The domestication of our animals would be one of the simpler things. But as far as like what we do culturally, there's nothing related to that.
I have a really specific. I really love looking at rock art and cave sites. And I think one of the things I love so much about it is that you can never understand what those paintings meant. And we can guess, and we can do projects that will give us an idea, but ultimately it's always only going to be a suggestion, because we can never put ourselves in that position. You know, there's actually, I heard a saying once that was, if the lion could speak English, we still wouldn't be able to understand it, because it would just be a totally different world. And I always try and apply that to when looking at rock art, because we can always try and infer a meaning onto it. But because like you say, our societies are so different, so far removed. It is an alien.
Sure.
An alien society, isn't it? So really there's no way to ever understand it fully.
Wow. It's a profound way to think about it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It makes you wonder too, you know, they say that it wouldn't take that long for our society to just be engulfed by the land, everything, I mean, even cars and the plastics on the cars in a human lifetime. Yeah. It seems like they take a long time to break down, but in the scheme of the world, a 3.8 billion year old planet, it would just be swallowed up in a matter of maybe 1,000 years.
Yeah. It's such a blip, such a short period of time in relevance.
Sure. And it makes me wonder, well, we're kind of established now, but who knows? You never know. I mean, we're kind of a stupid animal trying to kill each other. And if at some point, we end up doing that and some people survive, what are they going to be digging up from us in you know, 30,000 years and trying to put meaning behind it?
Yeah, I think being archaeologist, I always like to think what this society would look like if it was excavated, you know, in 10,000 years or so. And I find that so interesting to think about.
And to put it into perspective, it would be like someone coming to your neighborhood and digging up, I don't know, a St. Michael's pendant that you wore around your neck, and that's it. That's all they got. And trying to show what you did.
I actually have a necklace of it's a piece of deer antler.
Oh, really?
I always think, you know, if you were to be buried with that, and then someone to dig it up, then we would try and infer all sorts of ritual activity, you know.
Ah, you're a multi millennial troll.
Yeah. Look, they deposited him with deer antler, so. Must have been master of the deer.
That's hysterical. I want to do that now. I'm going to go around and troll people thousands of years from now by burying random things together.
It's the ultimate commitment to a joke.
That's right. I'm gonna like take a spoon and bury it with like you're right, like a deer antler and maybe some plastic fake jewelry from my daughter's thing, and know that it'll be around 1,000 years. I'll be like, what the hell is this?
That's
great. The one thing that I think is going to persevere is once you know, we kind of perfect that and it sort of learns to propagate itself or learns to perpetuate itself, I guess. Even stuff like this, these conversations that we have are going to be at least I think preserved for quite a long time. And one of the reasons, this might be right up your alley, one of the reasons why I started this podcast was I kind of wanted to put a time capsule together for my kids, because by the time my kids and I can have deep philosophical conversations, I'm going to be in my 60s. And as you know, well, you may not know it yet, but every decade of your life goes by, you become a different person. It's almost like a long lost cousin. When I look back at myself when I was 29, I'm 39 now, but when I was 29, I'm like, yeah, we were kind of similar, but not, you know, we have different thoughts now. And then especially when I was 19 or even 9, you know, we were completely different. This is a way that I can record my thoughts and feelings and have them revisit it when they're, you know, in their 40s and say, wow, this is what Dad was all about.
Yeah, I think it's so thinking about yourself in the past, especially we were speaking about this, especially even coming to, so this is a new university for me. So I've only been here 7-8 months.
Okay.
Like, even thinking about this, you know, myself at the start of the year to now, like the amount of knowledge that I've gained and you know, the work that I've done is always going to make me a different person.
It's stuff that you can't even think about. Like, I mean, it's stuff that it'll broadside you and you take it all as, I guess, life lessons. And then everything, and it's the old cliche term, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you strong, but it's true. Because, yeah. I mean, if it kills you, that's fine, end of game, and it doesn't matter. if it doesn't kill you, in 10 years from now, you'll look back on it and realize how important it was. Like, I had no intention of going to a combat zone in Iraq. No intention whatsoever. And when it happened, it sucked, and the immediate aftermath sucked, but now it's been 10 years. And I look back on it and I see what it's done, you know, for me, to me. And without it, I wouldn't be who I am. So I'm actually, if someone said, hey, would you like to go back in time and not get shot at? I would probably say no, because A, I know I survived it. B, who knows where I'd be right now? And I kind of like where I am.
Yeah.
And that's all. That's the dichotomy of life. That's the short versus the long term. Yeah, I guess, and I think that was one of the questions I asked you in the email. Does studying things so long ago, and to kind of bring this into full circle, how does it impact your life? Does it give you good perspective on the importance of you know, living now, living in the present, or is it something that you just don't consider yet?
I think so. I'm a fairly spontaneous person, I think. And, you know, I like to just wake up of a day and we'll go here, we'll do this. And my girlfriend, she's always saying that it's quite hard because she likes to plan. And then I will wake up one day and be like, no, forget that plan. We're going to the, like, you know, we're going out hiking over there.
That's the yin and yang of life, my friend.
Yeah.
I can tell you my wife is the same exact way. She's a planner, and I'll mention something over the weekend. I'll say, hey, do you know what? Maybe we should think about doing this. And then I forgot about it by the time the weekend comes, and she has written it down and already has what time we should be there.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a universal thing.
Yeah. But I liked that. I think I like to live in the present, although I suppose you could say that I spend my whole life looking at the past. So maybe I don't.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So what's on the plate for Tom Bell coming up? So you're focusing on completing your master's, I assume. When are you going to be done with that?
So that finishes in September.
Oh, wow. So pretty soon.
Yeah. It's only a year, and then it'll be done. Then it's into the real world.
Yeah.
I think I haven't applied to do a PhD next year, so I'll find something to do, but ultimately I'd definitely like to continue studying, really.
Now do you find that this discovery of yours, this pendant, are you now the pendant guy? Does everyone know you as the pendant guy? Like, you can put on your PhD, just, hey, I'm the pendant guy, so.
And they'll just straight away just offer me it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great, actually. I even made it into the newspapers in my town, and all my friends, you know, they messaged me like, oh, you're on the front of the paper.
That's cool.
That's so cool.
Well, what's kind of cool about it, well, there's two things. One, I hope it doesn't mean you peaked early, because...
I think it might have done. I think there's a lot of archaeologists go through and never find something as cool as that. I hope to find something as cool, but that might be it.
That's funny. And what's going to be kind of neat, I think, for you is with hopes that you have a long and prestigious career, let's say when you're 85 years old, which would be a little over 60 years from now. And at that point, who knows what our societies will be like, but you'll be able to revisit this pendant. Cause I think I saw on one of the newspaper articles for you, it's kind of stuck in a piece of plastic right now, right?
Yeah, it's in a museum, yeah.
Okay, so you'll be able to revisit that and kind of, you know that it's only been a small percentage of its existence, but it's been your whole life, and it's kind of neat. It's kind of neat to have that.
Yeah, that's so very cool.
Yeah, which... Go ahead.
I hadn't thought about it in that sense, but you're so right. I really like that.
Yeah. What museum is it in?
It's in York Museum.
Okay, have you visited it?
Yeah, we actually, me and my girlfriend and the lecturers, we went to the opening of the exhibition.
Oh, that's cool.
And that's where there's some pictures taken of me holding it, and it's just a few of us went and got some pictures before the exhibition opened, and then went and had a look at it.
That's great. I'm too much of a ham. I would hang out by it all day and be like, "Hey, I found that."
there's a picture next to it of just my hand holding it.
Oh, really? Really? So your famous hand.
We go in and people are saying, "Oh, I wonder whose hand that is." Yeah. That's definitely mine. Yeah.
Just point to it and then kind of look at your hand and be like, "Oh, that looks very familiar, doesn't it?" All right, Tom, very interesting story. You got a lot of work cut out for you. I wish you all the best. And hopefully, you know, this luck continues to follow you. And then when the next big discovery comes, I'll give you a call and we can talk about that. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
Like us on facebook.com/WWIPodcast and at WWIPodcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitswhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.